Tonight's State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Garden State Debate. My name's Ryan, and this is the grand finale, final episode of Garden State Debate. So we looked very hard to find a special guest with us today, and we're very excited to be speaking with the Senate Majority Leader of the New Jersey State Legislature, Senator Loretta Weinberg, who's joining us for today's discussion. And obviously we're gonna have a lot to talk about. We've in the past throughout the first season, we've met with other folks, including some of the senator's colleagues and ex-colleagues, such as Bob Gordon, Senator O'Scanlan, and friends and colleagues outside of politics as well, including Nancy Erica Smith. But today we're here with Senator Weinberg to talk about how she got into public service, talk about all of the things that have gone on through her short stint of 28 plus years in the legislature, and from what I hear, some other activism that happened before that time. She has been the majority leader since 2012 and started in the assembly in 1992 and went to the Senate in 2005. That's what I have for my, maybe she'll correct me if I'm wrong on that. But one other thing before we get Senator Weinberg is funny story. When I first met Senator Weinberg, actually via phone, I was just giving her a little background about myself before I had a question for her on something that she was working on. And she stopped me in the middle of the conversation and started laughing. And I didn't know what she was laughing about. And she said, "Ryan, I just got to ask you, you know, you're giving me all of these details about yourself and your fam. And I just have to ask, are you single?" Yeah. And I was like, she's like, "This sounds like a dating app." And from there, it's been a very interesting and fun conversations that we've had together. Also very serious on some serious topics such as New Jersey Transit and other things. So with that, I'd like to welcome you, Senator Weinberg. Thank you for coming on Garden State Debate. How are you holding up? And I know it's been tough through the pandemic. So just want to introduce yourself and say hello.
Hi, Ryan. Thank you very much for including me here and for remembering our first visit. You know, as I've reminded you, being a Jewish mom and a Jewish grandmother, we're always on the lookout for some kind of single people because I was sure I had a girl for you somewhere. So, I'm glad we both had a chance to laugh. It's humor that gets us through some of the darkest days, which we are living through right now with the pandemic. I live and work in Teaneck, which was the epicenter when we first learned what was going on with COVID-19 back in March of this year. Teaneck was the first town to kind of recognize what was going on. And I will remember when I was following what was going on here and realized one day we had one case and the next day, literally, we had eight cases. Holy Name Hospital, which is a few blocks, again, from where I live and where I work, was the epicenter of the medical first responders. So we kind of, you know, kind of experienced this from the beginning. And there are so many things that go through my mind when you ask, how are you holding up? First of all, learning about really the shortcomings what we need to address, educational opportunities. I really worry about what's happening to this generation of youngsters who are losing out in this school year for all the aforementioned reasons. Those kids that are not as well hooked up to Wi-Fi or live in a single parent household where the parent is working and can't stay home and supervise what is going on with the child's education. I worry about that. I worry about people's access to healthcare, and this pandemic has really put a spotlight onto issues like that. Hopefully with new national leadership and with a national message that can be translated through the states, we can start overcoming this. I think Governor Murphy has done an excellent job of keeping the residents informed, of trying to keep us all on the same road of understanding that the only tools we have right now, beside the new treatments, which hopefully you're not in the hospital, so you don't have to take advantage of new treatments, and the vaccine, which is still a little ways off, the tools we have are within our command and our responsibilities. Wear a mask, wash your hands, socially distant, don't go into big crowds. We can all control that. And if we can do that for the duration, the next 2 to 3 months, we'll be through this, we'll have the vaccine, and we can all write books and stories about life in COVID-19.
Right. No, that's very good thoughts in terms of how the pandemic has highlighted some of the cracks in our society and showed them and shined, cast a light on some of the weaknesses there. And it should be interesting to see how people react once there is an opportunity to change certain things that certainly don't happen overnight that could impact something like this if it were to happen in 5 or 10 more years. But one question on the pandemic before we kind of circle back to your kind of career and history and getting into things like that. Do you work closely, and you or the legislature, in terms of pandemic related figures and facts and decision making? Or is there a little bit of a pain point there in terms of communication, or is it a mix? And then the second question is the whole discussion around the second wave here in terms of cases, obviously a big uptick in New Jersey, even more in other parts of the country. Do you foresee it getting worse, both from a health perspective and from a potential second lockdown or restriction perspective? That's basically kind of like my two questions on the pandemic, the working relationship, as well as what you foresee, and not from we're not doctors here, but kind of how you see the next few months playing out. You mentioned the vaccine, but other than that.
Most of what's been done has been done under the governor's emergency powers through emergency orders. The legislature has cooperated, helped, joined in the way we structured our budget. We did the budget in two parts this past year, which was a first. We did a three-month budget at the beginning of the pandemic, and then completed the nine-month budget in a second stage. We'd never done anything like that before. We have backed up some of the governor's emergency orders with legislation to make sure they will withstand any kind of court challenge. So although much, as I said, has been done through executive order, I think there is a great sense of cooperation across the aisle and with the administration. There's too many important issues for us to get into turf fights or partisan fights in this area. We are the most densely populated state in the United States. So obviously, we are going to be more affected, I guess, you would assume, than a place like North Dakota. But when you look into the Midwest, they have caught up with us. They are suffering from not enough acute care beds and all the other things that we went through a few months ago. So nobody's immune, even if you live in North Dakota or any place in the Midwest where you have plenty of room around you. So we are at least blessed here with wonderful healthcare institutions, with first responders who have more than risen to the terrible challenges that are in front of them. And I hope that we can continue cooperating like this and we can get through the next few months so that this all recedes into our collective memories.
Right. Thank you. No, I appreciate that. So I just wanted to also then circle back. I know this probably could take up several hours, and I don't want to condense your legacy into just 45 minutes or an hour, but let's try to touch on some of the high points. And I think people might be interested. You know, there's a lot of, we have a lot of population inflow and outflow. So there's folk, younger folks and people that may not know the history, but definitely know, you know, of current events, what's being worked on, a lot of what we just talked about. So can you just start by telling us, giving the listeners, viewers, and myself a little bit of background about yourself? I know you're still extremely sharp at your very young age, but give us a little background about when you started in politics, or maybe even before, and what drove you to this legislature. Let's start there.
Well, I started in politics like many other people in my generation. It was the 60s. We moved to Teaneck, my husband and I, with two little babies, a year and 2 years old, both bought our first house on the GI Bill. He had been a veteran of the Korean War. And once we set down roots in the community, I said, I went out and volunteered in what was then the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, and I never quite made it home in time to unpack that last box of dishes that's still someplace in my garage, which I'll find someday when I vacate these premises. So everybody I knew was involved in some form of civic activism. And that's how we made our friends in Teaneck. That's how my kids made their friends. We were in that era, there were many of us who were stay-at-home moms, a luxury that my daughter's generation does not take advantage of or does not enjoy. And so one thing led to the other, and that was the origins. I went to my first Teaneck council meeting. I often describe it because I was a little nervous about the lack of trees on our main street in Cedar Lane. We had moved from West 75th Street in Manhattan, where we had trees outside, and I thought I was moving to the country. And I had the two babies in the tandem stroller. They're 14 months apart. And there were no trees to stand under. It was hot. So that kind of piqued my interest. And I often describe that 40 years later, they're still trying to figure out what kind of trees to plant on Cedar Lane that will actually last. So I always point to it as not one of my finest triumphs in government. But that was my first appearance at a Teaneck council meeting. In 1990, my kids were grown. You can figure out my age pretty easily, but it was 30 years ago. I ran for my first elective office. I had always been the volunteer, the organizer, the whatever behind the scenes with a lot of other women. And I ran for council in Teaneck. We have nonpartisan government. So we filed for office in March. The shooting of Philip Pinnell, a African-American young man, by a white police officer took place in April, a month after I filed for office, and the election was in May when I was elected to the Teaneck Council. And it was a huge learning experience for me. We, even at that time, televised our council meetings, which was pretty advanced.
Wow.
And the council meetings, we had people coming from all over, beginning with Al Sharpton in his prior life, who used to come before our council meetings, to people way on the other side of the coin politically and how they looked upon this shooting. And it was one of the stories that I tell is a colleague of mine, a woman whom I had worked with as a volunteer, an African-American woman who had two sons close in age to my two kids, who told me, now I'm going back 30 years and I can still remember the story. She told me that she taught her sons to hold their money in their hand when they walked into a store so they wouldn't be accused of shoplifting. And I can remember being so taken aback. We both lived in Teaneck. We both seemed to come from economically middle class families. We each had a house with a backyard and we each had two kids. How different our experiences really were, because I would never think that I had to teach my children a defensive move. They wouldn't have been accused of shoplifting unless they were shoplifting. So that story stayed with me as a window into what I didn't know and how I had to listen. So it's those first couple of years on the Teaneck Council that really, I think, shaped a lot of my political career because of this chaotic time that I came into office. In 1992, Mattie Feldman resigned or did not run again for his Senate seat. Byron Bair was moving up to the Senate, and there was an opening in the Assembly at the time. And I decided I would go for it. The replacement is picked by a convention of county committee people. And I went up against a couple of guys in that convention and won this seat in the Assembly. And I brought into that seat in the Assembly. By the way, there were only 22 Democrats out of 80 in the Assembly at the time.
We were talking now.
In 1992.
Right, okay.
And it was at we were at our smallest numbers.
So there's only 22.
You want to talk about being irrelevant.
Right, and about how many women were in the Assembly?
Then I was for a time, the only woman in the Democratic caucus out of the 22 of us in the Assembly at that point. And so I learned how to carry out office in a distinct minority and how one tries to build relationships to get some bills passed. And it was actually out of the Teaneck experience where I got really the first big bill I was ever involved with passed in the Assembly. And that was a bill that enlarged the pool from which jurors are picked. So it did away with a lot of the exemptions and put almost everybody into the jury pool.
Do you recall like any big?
Well, there were exemptions. Certain medical personnel were exempt. Jury duty, police, so on. And it came out of the lack of confidence that some people in Teaneck had at the time with the jury system in dealing with the shooting of an African-American young person by a white police person. The jury in that case was an all-white jury. So it was, how do you fix that? You can't mandate certain kinds of diversity on juries. All you can do is make sure the pool is big enough. And I got that bill passed in that assembly, being a distinct minority in numbers. And it really came out of the Teaneck experience.
Wow.
So that was a little bit of my life before. You know, I didn't arrive in the New Jersey Assembly as somebody completely inexperienced. And I remember, I think, hopefully he's still around, the assemblyman at the time, Republican Assemblyman Gary Stulltrager, who was, I think, chair of the Judiciary Committee where this bill about the jurors had to go through. And I was, you know, figuring out how to get myself through that. And there were issues around some amendments. And I went to him about it. And I remember him looking at me straight in the eye with saying, "Hey, it's your bill. You make the decision." And I was like, "Really?" So he taught me a little bit, probably doesn't even know it. But, he taught me how to behave like a grown up.
Yeah, he had to hit the ground running with that one.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning. So,
that's a little bit about how I arrived in 1992. And then when Byron Bear, who was my Senate predecessor, stepped down, was when I moved up and got into the public brawl, best way to describe it, with my own county leader who wanted some tall white guy in the position rather than me. And we ended up again in a convention where there were forgeries. And I mean, so many things went on. And we ended up at a result of a court fight. I ended up winning the convention. So nothing actually came very easy in my political life. It always seemed to be some chaos either around me in the environment or as a direct result of my being involved.
So that's interesting, a lot of it, but how the Senate, how you got into the Senate through that court kind of situation is very, very interesting. So it wasn't just like an outright, I won an election vote and there I was in the Senate or anything like that.
Nope. And when I walked into the Senate the first time from after winning this court battle, it had to do with votes in the convention and votes that the other side tried to get thrown out, which were legitimate votes, which enabled me to win the convention by 2 votes. So when I walked into the Senate the first time after getting sworn in, one of the senior members of the Senate, instead of saying welcome or hi, he had a tough fight, said to me, "Just remember, you're not coming in here with seniority," meaning from the assembly. "You have to start all over again." And I remember thinking, I mean, I hadn't exactly come galloping in on a white horse with, you know, some list of demands, but I remember looking at him. Another thing that stayed in my mind, because I was very proud of my snarky response, I said to him, "I'll try to forget everything I know." And I just away. So as I said, that stayed in my memory because I'm pretty good, Loretta. I patted myself on the back for that comeback.
Very good. So So your Senate career then began in 2005. And obviously, elections since then, hopefully, probably didn't go the same way in terms of their.
Then it became easy.
Have you lost an election as it relates to the Senate since that time?
No, I've lost a couple of elections in my life. I ran for county executive in 1998 as a favor to my party against a very popular Republican incumbent, you know, pre-Trump days. So somebody who today probably in his party would be considered almost a Democrat. And I lost that election again in a time of upheaval in my own personal life. Was right when my husband was a cancer survivor up until that point when he got sick again. And really, I took a long break from the campaign, a lot going on. And he did pass away in February of 1999, but I lost that election. And I was still in the assembly, so I was still in elected office.
You also ran for
and I lost the election as part of the Corzine Weinberg team. So
those I was going to ask you about that. So do you have any stories, or can you provide a little insight as to how that experience went as running for lieutenant governor with Corzine?
Well, I say to people that was the most fun campaign that I've ever been in my long experience. Except the losing part. It was a campaign that I wasn't in charge of anything, which I realized from the day I got involved. I didn't have to worry about raising the money. I wasn't in charge of whatever the public relations communications people were doing. All I had to do was get in the car, travel around, give a speech, greet people, get a round of applause, and move on to the next one. So I had a really I entered it with the idea that I was going to have a fun experience, and I did, because first of all, I got to realize what New Jersey was really like. I used to kid Joe Roberts, who was a former Speaker of the Assembly, and then Steve Sweeney, current Senate President, that I didn't know that there was a whole state beyond Trenton. I always thought Trenton was South Jersey. And when I found out there was a whole state down there, and our first trip when I became the candidate, forever embedded in my memory, it was July. It was very hot. And my kids had arrived from California, my daughter and son-in-law and two grandchildren, not knowing that I was going to be the lieutenant governor candidate. It actually happened while they were on the plane flying here. So they had descended upon my house along with a couple of staff people that were sent. And that next day I was unveiled at this big public gathering as the lieutenant governor candidate and then sent on the road. And we were sent way down to South Jersey to a 4-H farm conclave of some kind. Literally, want to talk about an area that I wasn't familiar with. And we were at one point in the Corzine auto thing. And, you know, they're going through red lights. They have the blue lights on their car and we're just in regular cars. So I said to young man who is driving, you know, Rocco, we're going to get killed in this thing and they're not going to miss a beat. They'll find the Corzine Barbara Buono signs in the basement and immediately resurrect them. Anyway, we finally made it. We finally got through all these 4-H fairs and it was 11 o'clock at night and I was exhausted. It had been, you know, the family arriving, this big thing, hot as can be, and me traipsing around these 4-H fairs. I said to Rocco, we didn't even have a GPS at that point. do you know how to get home from here? And he looked at me and he said, I don't even know where we are. Which, and that was the honest to goodness truth. It was like a Wild West movie. Well, I see lights over there, head in that direction. So that was the opening of my being a lieutenant governor. And I met the most wonderful people in traveling around this state. It gave me, you know, I make kind of fun of this whole state there, but it gave me such an appreciation for the kind of people that make up the state of New Jersey. And even though I lost, or we lost, I was only part of that team. It to me was an experience that I wouldn't trade for a lot of other things. And then the other funny part, when we came home the night after losing the election that night, very late, and I live in a condo where we have so-called guard at the gate. And apparently it was like the middle of the night. I don't know the guy who's on in the middle of the night. And so we got to the gate and he looked out, you know, like, who's there? So Rocco said, I have Loretta Weinberg, I'm bringing her home. And he was like, who? And my daughter, who was in the back seat, is laughing with, they don't even know who you are anymore. Because ordinarily the daytime gates would be, oh, Mrs. Weinberg, you're a rock star. And they'd be giving me, you know, applauding me. And now I'm coming home after losing. The guy doesn't even know who I am. And the next day, and this is the honest to goodness truth, the next day I go out to the mailbox and get my mail. And there is a card that says you're due for your colonoscopy. And I remember really laughing to myself, thinking this is the end of a perfect week. Oh, the guard doesn't know who I am and I'm due for my colonoscopy.
You were forgotten after that.
So there's my lieutenant governor stories.
That's good. I think a lot of people find that interesting. And
real life.
Yeah. And then also, like you said, you got more experience to get around the state and see other parts, probably obviously enhance your legislative experience and things like that from that point forward. How about Bridgegate? I know that, you know, from media and other folks, it sounds like you sniffed out Bridgegate. You kind of were in the middle of it. Can you give us your view of
how Bridgegate went down?
Everyone kind of puts it in a bucket with Governor Christie, but there's other parties involved. So what's Senator Weinberg's story of?
Well, I attribute that to my experiences of raising two adolescents and knowing when somebody wasn't quite telling me the whole truth. And I started to get these complaints in the office about the traffic. Well, you know, there were very often complaints about traffic around the George Washington Bridge, but this was becoming a little bit more pronounced. And I read an article in The Record written by then a columnist who they called the Road Warrior, who actually wrote stories about traffic, used to be printed in The Record. So I thought that, you know, something is going on here. And I wrote to Pat Schubert, who was then a member of the Port Authority Commissioner from Bergen County, a former Bergen County executive. In fact, the man to whom I lost that county executive race. And I had supported, as a member of the Senate, his appointment to the Port Authority because I knew how important the Port Authority was with the George Washington Bridge right in the midst of the district I represent. So I was so glad to see somebody who understood Bergen County and the traffic problems. I always said, if somebody sneezes on the Cross Bronx Expressway, we get the traffic jam in Fort Lee and beyond. So I wrote to him saying, what went on here? What is going on here? Why were these lanes closed, et cetera? And he called me on the phone after getting the letter and said, I will follow up. And I never heard anything back. And I had CC'd the governor, Mark Sokolich, the mayor of Fort Lee, on that letter. And I didn't hear from them either. So I said to my staff, you know, we should go to a Port Authority meeting. It's just kind of a throwaway, you know, I can't tell you where the idea came from. So they looked up on the internet when the next meeting was, and they said, there is no meeting for a few weeks, but there is a subcommittee on government and ethics, I think it was called, and it's headed by Pat Schubert, and they are having a subcommittee meeting. So I said, well, that sounds like a good committee you go to. Let's go to that. And we sent them an email, because they don't usually take testimony at subcommittees, asking if I could appear. I found out afterwards, as we subpoenaed documents, that they spent more time sending emails back and forth on whether they should let me speak than they ever spent actually investigating what went on in their own house. And when I walked into that meeting, I, to my knowledge, not met David Weilstein before. He was, somebody pointed him out, he was in the corner texting. And Bill Baroni, whom I knew, who was a Senate colleague of mine, who was a co-sponsor on marriage equality with me, I could just tell by his behavior that something was up. He would usually be very open and friendly to me, kept his eyes down. And I walked out of that committee meeting. I will tell you, I knew then that there was something big going on here and that they were all covering it up. And that's why I kept on going to Port Authority meetings and kept on asking questions until with the help of the press, we were able to finally get through at least to the Bridgegate hearings, which left more unanswered questions, but was really the big spotlight onto what happened in Bridgegate. And I guess torpedoed the governor's aspirations for the White House, but here we are, how many years later? And we have the same cast of characters, kind of interesting to me. A lot of people from Bridgegate, Bill Stepien, political guru in the White House, even the current Attorney General played a role in the Bridgegate operation.
Remember?
Who's our attorney? The name is some having my senior moment with...
No, that's fine. I'm just curious because that's...
Yeah. I'm talking about the federal. He was the one who ended up...
William Barr, you're talking about?
No. Pardon me. The head of the FBI.
Oh, okay.
Right. Who, by the way, Joe Biden has talked about keeping. And he's the one who ended up with Christie's infamous telephone that we could never find. And many of the other people are in various nonprofit or government lobbying positions, and Chris Christie is positioning himself for another run. So in some ways, things haven't changed at all.
So why do you think nobody got prosecuted in that investigation?
Well, that was up to the U.S. attorney.
Yeah.
And he chose for whatever reasons he had that he's never really talked about publicly, other than that's where he thought he had the best evidence. And we know, you know, the courts eventually threw out those convictions, and they've both been very quiet since then. So I suspect there's a book coming or something that's coming out of that. We'll see.
Well, I'm going to ask you later, not now, if you're exploring retirement, but we're going to leave that for the end. Speaking of the books.
Okay.
But I wanted to ask you, and please feel free to chime in on any legislation or things that you're involved in, similar to some of the stuff that we've been talking about. And we're eventually going to hopefully get to some of the current issues, such as, I know you're working on New Jersey transit stuff. I know cannabis legislation is going through and other things like that. But before we get to that, I know a lot of people talk about, long before it became kind of a mainstream topic in this country and or in the state, you were involved in equal rights and LGBTQ and things like that. And I think somebody even told me, did you preside over the first gay marriage in New Jersey, or it was in your area? Do you have any thoughts and any context on kind of that history in your personal experience with that and the
problem? Well, I think that, you know, that mostly came out of my experiences of becoming a grown-up adult political activist during the 60s. So marriage equality was a very important issue, which I understood, not only because I knew and loved people who happened to be gay. I had people in my extended family. So I certainly understood that early on. And marriage equality was a fight. It took a while, even for members of my own party to evolve to the state of being able to support it, which is why we started out first with domestic partnership, which was the first bill we passed. And it was a very limited bill, did not do very much for people, except public employees who are entitled to some pension and healthcare benefits. But after domestic partnership was signed into law, I was invited to speak at a rally in Maplewood that was done by, was put together then by Stephen Goldstein, who was at that point the head of marriage equality. And I remember being there, there must have been, Ryan, 1,000 people. I was shocked when I saw the size of the crowd there. And I think I said it in my remarks. I never have done so little when it came right down to what the effect of this was. So little that made so many people happy. And, you know, I realized it was just the first step and we had a long road. We went from there to civil unions, to finally marriage equality, to Chris Christie vetoing it, which always bothered me because I know he didn't believe what he was doing, but he did it to appeal to that element of his own party, to the Supreme Court deciding marriage equality. So it was a road that had a happy ending, but it took a while. Also taught me about discipline and focus. Keep your eye on it and take the steps you can take and get ready for the next step. And it was the same way with banning smoking indoors, which I played a big role in, which I think affected a lot of people's lives, or the bill that required health insurance companies to pay for 48 hours of aftercare for new moms and their babies. There was that period of time when you were supposed to have, if you had your baby at 8 o'clock in the morning, you're supposed to go home at 8 o'clock at night because the health insurance companies didn't want to pay beyond that. When I had my babies, you could stay in the hospital for 5 days. And then I was faced with looking at women being thrown out at the end of 12 hours, literally. So that was another big bill, fighting the insurance companies. Right up until the time we voted on the floor, they tried to get an amendment through on that bill that said, yeah, you could stay beyond 12 hours, quote, if medically necessary. Sounded like three benign words, but really took the guts out of the bill. Another lesson I learned that you have to watch every single step that's happening because they might try to steal it right from under your nose. I worked very hard with Rose Heck on that, who is an assemblywoman on the other side of the aisle, a Republican. So those are the issues that I get the most joy out of having participated in, because I think they are the issues that really affect the quality and the health of the lives of families here right. in New Jersey. And then moving ahead into this whole issue of women's rights and
and I had another question as well, kind of similar, semi-related to that. And from what I understand, you're involved pretty heavily with the Katie Brennan situation with the governor's administration and sexual harassment case. And you kind of led some investigation or sort of process of highlighting that experience and working around it. So can you share with us that experience?
Yes. And what you we had hearings on what took place there. And I admire Katie Brennan. I admired her then. I didn't know her.
Yeah, maybe just like a quick, slight little background on it too.
Oh, yeah. Well, Katie Brennan was a state employee. Well, I guess she wasn't a state employee at the time. She was a volunteer in the Murphy for Governor campaign and made an accusation of sexual harassment against one of the campaign officials. And from that came several other women who came forth anonymously or some with their names, talking about a toxic culture against women in the first Murphy campaign. So that's kind of the backdrop of it. Lots of stories, you know, immediately when you make an accusation about somebody, this is common, immediately there were stories about Katie Brennan. You know, there was, she must have been a little bit of a wild woman for this to have happened to her, and why was he in her apartment, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, we had the hearings. A lot was pointed up about the way law enforcement handles cases like this. I think the governor himself, through the attorney general, moved to improve things a bit. But by the time this broadcast goes on, we will have had, I believe, a law and public safety committee meeting in the New Jersey Senate, in which the first series of bills that came out of those hearings, and then a woman's work group that I put together outside of the legislature that came out of a series of articles that appeared in the Ledger about the pervasive misogyny that was really going on in politics in New Jersey, and how many women felt in terms of how they were treated, whether they were on the train ride to Washington done by the Chamber of Commerce or at the League of Municipalities or at various places. So we had, I had those two things coming, the work group and the hearings. And we have the first series of legislation that came out of that. And I'll give you a one, for instance. When Katie Brennan decided to press charges, she went down to the local police station, I guess it was in her town, and filled out a police report. She did not see that police report for a few months. And it turned out that when she read it, she did not feel it reflected accurately what she told the police. So again, we have one bit of legislation going through that requires when somebody goes to the police station, I'm not talking about a time when police come and investigate a crime, but when the police are only filing a report based upon what you say happened to you, you should be given a copy of that report, have a form, which if you disagree with anything that's in that report, you can so note it, and then that gets filed with the report. Because as if, for instance, and I'll point this out about how just the use of language can influence something, that she described to the police that she was showing him a view out the window of what view she had of New York in her living room. In the police report, it said they were looking out the window in her bedroom. So that puts a whole new connotation. And I point that out because those are the kinds of things that we were looking at, how unequal it is from one county prosecutor to another on whether they choose to prosecute the he said, she said cases. So as I said, by the time this gets broadcast, I hope we will have seen those bills released from committee and maybe even going up for a vote in the Senate.
That's excellent. Yeah, so just so the viewers are aware, probably be broadcast recording around the weekend of the 5th of November, and this would come out probably sometime during the week of the 14th. So the center is referring to legislation between now and then. So make sure you check that out, and hopefully we'll see some.
If it is played the week of the 14th, we will have a voting session on December 17th. So you might be able to see what happens there.
Okay. And I don't know if I said November, I meant December. Getting a little brain dead here at the end of the year. So that's great that there's legislation coming out of that and the work that you did there, obviously, to kind of spotlight the need for it. I had another question for you before we get into some other current legislation, which was your general relationship with the Senate president. I think a lot of people, from what I read, view yourself as someone that might be a little bit more progressive and view the Senate president as more of a moderate. But in total, in aggregate, it seems like a working relationship that is getting bills passed, I guess, and would be assumed to be getting things done. So can you describe that relationship a little bit and any dynamics?
First of all, I think we have respect for each other. And I point out to people all the time that the legislation that I get credit for as being the prime sponsor of, I would not be able to get passed if the Senate president was not fully supportive. So all of this progressive legislation came out of this Senate, headed by this Senate president, who has complete control over the agenda of the Senate. So whether I talk about the bills that we're working on now, that in terms of sexual harassment, or things like having passed the strongest bill to say that people cannot be forced to sign non-disclosure agreements in the state of New Jersey to keep these kinds of things secret, that's outlawed in New Jersey now, or bills like family leave, like earned sick leave, Those are all bills that were passed under this Senate president. They have my name on them, but I would not have been able to get them before the legislature. So I think he is more progressive than people think. His persona is very different, and he represents a different set of experiences from mine, but he has been, in my opinion, really supportive of these kinds of legislative endeavors. And I appreciate that. Sometimes it takes a little bit of more nagging, stamping up my feet or hissy fits or whatever. But generally, I feel we've got a very good partnership that has furthered things in the legislature that I fervently believed in, and sometimes things that I support a little less.
Got it. Thank you for that clarification. So I had another question for you then, as it relates to some current legislation, and that is New Jersey Transit, which has been your baby. I guess whether you took it on by choice or not, I think a lot of the state associates New Jersey Transit's inefficiencies or successes and failures with some of the stuff that you attempt to either play the like bully pulpit in the media or through your reform bills and things like that. So can we talk a little bit about how you got into that New Jersey Transit kind of oversight role? And then we can move on to maybe the reform bills and what you're expecting here.
Yeah, you know, Brian, that almost really started with Bridgegate, which started me going to Port Authority meetings, which started me to realize about the bus terminal, that we have this huge bus terminal in New York, which 230,000 people went through each and every other day, that the Port Authority never even talked about in its capital plan, which started me on the road to, hey guys, we're here in New Jersey. This affects the quality of life. So I had a town hall meeting around that, and it was, and I had it in Teaneck, and I've asked a couple of people from the Port Authority and a couple of people from New Jersey Transit to come and talk to residents. We're a big bus commuting area. There are no trains in this portion of Bergen County that I represent. So again, I remember being somewhat surprised. We advertised this town hall, and it was, you know, like 7 o'clock on a weeknight. And people were literally streaming in, some who had just gotten off the bus coming back from New York, who came directly to the meeting. And I heard such horror stories about what the commute is like in terms of the buses and the bus terminals. And I heard from New Jersey Transit. And this is such a quality of life for the residents I represent pre-COVID. Was, you know, can they get home in time to have dinner with their family or see their kids, or has the bus been canceled, or is it always late, or the bus terminal is such a horror to get through? Can they leave for work? They should be able to leave for work at a normal hour to get to work, but do they have to leave at 5:30 in the morning? So many stories came. And again, you know, I always remember these individuals. The woman who stood up and said, I leave work in time to pick up my children from daycare. If I am 1 minute past 6 o'clock, I have to pay extra money. And it cost me something, if I remember correctly, $500 this month, just because I was late, even though I left in time. So that's what kind of got me into the whole New Jersey Transit. And so came from the Port Authority to the bus terminal, right, to the people I represent. And I don't want to run New Jersey Transit. But we had hearings in the legislature on that too. I don't believe, as a state senator, I'm the person who should make a decision about one door versus two door buses. So to me, the best solution was to try to have a real, responsible, accountable, transparent board to run New Jersey Transit. And with former Senator Bob Gordon, who's now a member of the transit board, we kind of started on that road. And that was the first so-called reform bill that we passed, which gave more responsibility to the board. But we've realized that there are some gaps in that. And we have a second bill that hopefully will be before the state legislature, maybe even before a committee by the time this program is heard, which closes some of those gaps. I believe that the answer for New Jersey Transit is the right people on a board that will ask questions and then have the subjects presented to them so they can ask the questions in a very transparent, responsible, and accountable way. And so that's the last piece of this reform bill, at least for now, that we are pushing for.
Okay, understood. And I think all of that makes a lot of sense, but you still seem to be, again, not by choice, still having a role in pushing for things. So I wonder if a question would be for you, just within the transit organization itself, the board can govern it, you know, from an oversight perspective, but based on some of the stories you just told and things you read every day, such as the most recent Academy bus, kind of where the AG stepped in on where Academy bus and a third party carrier was intentionally lowering their kind of trip counts while they were instead canceling buses and having that kind of impact on people like you imagine. So from a cultural interior perspective of New Jersey Transit outside of the board, do you think that the current senior management has made any progress, or that it's time to turn the page and move on from what they have? In other words, if you agree with what's being said between these people and the media, how do you kind of shake through that culture and get it out? And do you think the senior management team needs to be replaced?
Well, first of all, by allowing the board to hire the senior manager at NJ Transit, so that will be a more open, transparent, inclusive manner. But I think Academy Bus points up really to me what's kind of interesting. Here is a board. This senior management reported that contract to the board, asked for their vote, with apparently either an inability to know what went wrong there or just not wanting to acknowledge what was going wrong there, because they did not monitor that contract. And then on the heels of that, you have almost 2 days later, the Attorney General launching an investigation and the governor vetoing these minutes. So I would think that if the governor chose to veto those minutes, appropriately so, that there would be some investigation internally into how this ended up on that agenda to begin with. and what had gone on with that contract? And when will the board, in an open board meeting, discuss that? So, I think it really points up why we need a more accountable board who is going to be responsible for, in an open way, for these kinds of things. Now, I listened, I saw it on the Twitter feed, a subcommittee meeting, which was published on the Twitter feed by one of the advocate groups. And I actually listened to it. And there were actually questions from the subcommittee questioning the senior management. Not sure that they got adequate answers. But again, if you look at, okay, the senior management presents to the board, the governor vetoes the minutes. Doesn't the governor want to know how this landed there? I think it points up a lot of the shortcomings. I hope that instead of fighting an accountable, responsible, really a board with enough power to be responsible, that the administration will join in fighting for that.
So does this academy bus thing smell fishy to you, similar to what you were saying?
Well, it doesn't only smell fishy to me, obviously smells fishy to people that have more power to look into it even than I do.
And so from what you said as well, do you think that the governor's slash board of directors are not pushing hard enough to get the answers they need to turn the agency around? Or do you think there's been progress?
I think that there is progress. It's very slow. And I would hope that the administration would be supportive in creating and helping to create such a board, because I think New Jersey Transit needs that kind of attention. It can't be overseen by this, the governor, the Department of Transportation commissioner, the executive director of NJ Transit, and sort of this humongous bureaucracy that kind of operates on its own. So with a board that meets publicly, where the board themselves can ask questions, and where the press can ask questions, and where people like you can cover what's going on, that will be the improvement. That's my opinion.
And through your reform bill number 2, just to kind of close out the subject, what are some of the big highlights there? From what I recall, it gives the opportunity to vote on the, because you just mentioned the bureaucracy of the CEO with the chair and others. It gives the opportunity for the board to vote on the chair of the board so that it is not
right now under the law, the commissioner of the Department of Transportation is the chairperson of the board. And under the new bill, the board itself would pick their chair. The commissioner of DOT stays on the board, obviously, and well, they should. That's an important liaison. But you've got, the Department of Transportation on one side is road building and the other side is mass transit. And before we leave that, i.e. COVID-19 and mass transit, we have these essential workers that have to get to work. They are the housekeepers in hospitals, the dietary workers, the people who work for Amazon and get all these packages out that we can get delivered to our front doors. These are essential workers who usually are taking mass transit, who deserve the same kind of protection the rest of us do. And I read recently, and it was a topic in that subcommittee meeting that I listened to this week, that they finally issued a summons to somebody who refused to wear a mask on board. Now, every day we hear, and rightly so, from the governor and hopefully from the new president, the importance of masks. So when you are on a bus, for crying out loud, or a train, that's where it's got to be enforced. These are the people who don't have other alternatives. And so, you know, where was the gap here? Why is it taking them so long to make sure that is a mandate in public transportation to protect the worker who's got to get to work? We're not now talking about people who are going for entertainment or things like that. These are essential workers, and they should be protected as best we can. So it's another classic example of New Jersey Transit kind of coming in the tail end of something rather than leading where they should be.
On the masking thing, it's a good point as well. There's another lawsuit, you know, alleged, you know, from a conductor. This was in the media in the last couple of weeks, who's from the widow of a conductor who passed away in the beginning. I think it might have been one of the first deaths of a New Jersey Transit employee. Mm-hmm. And they're suing New Jersey Transit for wrongful death. And you have the Academy for as it pertains to not being protected adequately with things such as PPE and stuff like that. So you have that going on. You have the Academy bus situation that you just laid out, and the lack of enforcement of masks. And we're 9 months in, and it's indoors, and it goes against, like you said, everything that we're being told on a daily basis from the governor. But it's all New Jersey Transit is under the governor's, you know, jurisdiction in a way. And then a recent even internal audit allegation from an internal auditor saying that basically they were reporting up issues for 6 years to senior management or to the audit committee, and nobody was paying attention to these things. I think they sent recently a letter even to your office. That's what the media story said, I think, out of the record.
Right. To which, by the way, we did respond to the accusations they made, and we followed up on that at the time. So, but again, a classic example, if these audits are presented to the board in open meetings, they will be responded to. They can't be buried. And that's why I pin so much on the board. I get these Twitter feeds all the time asking me what I'm going to do about each of these issues. And like I said myself, I'm going to get my magic wand out and just make them all go away. I can't run New Jersey Transit. And I don't think any member of the legislature can or should. So if we have a board that does its job, then people will know. And the legislature can step in when and if it's necessary. And I feel the same way about the Port Authority and about these other big issues that I've been involved in. Because you can't answer them once. They also need constant overseeing, or you'll fall back into the old ways pretty quickly.
Right. One last question. You did do the oversight committee meetings from the Senate, and that stopped in February. So is that kind of being that's done for good based on your comments about the board, as far as you know?
I think, you know, COVID got in the way as it got in the way of so many other things. But I think we've been moving ahead with these issues around New Jersey Transit. And I appreciate the advocates who've helped us keep these issues in the spotlight. So hopefully, if we can get this last piece through, I can take a deep sigh, and when somebody tweets me, I can refer them to the board.
There you go. So you're calling out the board to get more hands on. I can tell.
Yeah.
So message received. I'm sure that New Jersey Transit tunes into this podcast for any number of reasons. So there you go. There's your message from Senator Weinberg on what needs to be done to shake it up. Last thing before we kind of sign off, just kind of hot burning news in New Jersey from the voters and the legislator is the, I didn't mean to make that reference in that way, but the cannabis legislation, calling it hot and burning, but how's that going? Why are there so many deliberations on it? Obviously, it's a very important thing from a decriminalization perspective, but why can't people come to an agreement and put this thing to bed?
Well, I think people will come to an agreement. There were a few, roadblocks that were sometimes we create for ourselves, by things like somehow getting magic mushrooms, whatever they are, involved with this whole thing. So I think we're coming to an agreement, and hopefully we'll see that all worked out in the very near future. It needs to be. It's a new industry. We need to get it off the ground in, again, an appropriate and fair manner. Another complex issue, because not only the business aspect and the regulation aspect, but it is the whole justice aspect. So there are, some overriding issues here, but as we do, we somehow manage to get it done, sometimes not as well as we should, but as best we can.
Got it. So you're a big supporter of the bill. You just want it, it'll get done. From a municipality standpoint, it allows the 500 plus municipalities to do what they wish in terms of selling and distribution. Do you agree with that? Do you think that it should be taken on across the state, or does it bring a lot of, does it not fit into certain parts of wealthier places or different parts of the state for various reasons?
It leaves really the responsibility that municipalities have now in terms of zoning. Do they want these, do they want certain kinds of businesses within their municipalities or don't? They have that, they have those rights right now. So I don't know, we'll see how it works out.
Right. I'm just thinking if 95% of the municipalities ban it, and then it ends up in poorer areas, is it doing its job from what was expected from the legislature? For an extreme example. Well,
the municipalities will gain from having these retail operations within their borders. And where I've seen it, a few years ago was at a family gathering in Seattle. And, they're right up the block from where we were having a big family dinner was one of the cannabis shops, which was not, which looked like a pretty nice retail operation. So we'll see how it all works out. And I think some municipalities will see them as welcome.
Got it. So you think it's more of a getting used to, comfortable, seeing what's going on type of situation that'll start to become embedded in a lot of New Jersey communities. So I know we're about up on time. So my last question is, are you retiring? The legislative folks are all up for re-election in November of 2021. Are you retiring anytime between now and at that period when your term is up? You want to break news on the Garden State debate.
I'm sorry, you can't have breaking news across a crayon here, but because I'm not giving it to you. I will give you the same answer I've given to my family, my colleagues, and all the news people have asked me. I am making my decision right after the first of the year, and right after I tell my family, I will tell.
Oh, so but you are making the decision right in the beginning of the year to allow, to allow whatever needs to happen to happen.
But you let me go
you
back.
You might have hinted at it. Maybe you.
I'm sorry.
You might have hinted at your decision by saying that. If you're making your decision, if you're making a decision in early 2021,
right,
a whole year in advance of potentially having.
Well, it's not a whole year in advance because we have a convention system that picks our candidates. So that starts in March.
March. So you got to leave time. April.
Yeah.
But then again, understand.
The election is a whole year off, but
either way, even if
you
are.
You also said that.
You got.
You also said that this broadcast that we're doing now is the last broadcast. You mean the last of this season, correct?
Yeah, so I won't be back. I might never be back, and if I am, it'll be like 2021.
Well, I don't know. I brought out my bottle of champagne.
That's
that we
awesome.
Can celebrate the last of the season and maybe drink a toast to a whole new season of great podcasts.
That's great. I appreciate that, Senator. Cheers to you. Here's my Diet Coke over here. We're really good. Wild on the last episode. Last question then for you is, whether it's over or not, obviously you've had a distinguished career. What legacy do you hope to leave behind? If and when it's over from a political career standpoint? And number two, do you see younger folks in the legislature that can carry on the torch? And if not, what values do you see that will be lead promising candidates in the future? That's a packed question.
Well, I've certainly learned in life that none of us is indispensable. And I've often said, and I guess if I have to sum it up, is that I will leave a whole generation of troublemakers behind me. And that some of those troublemakers will be in the legislature and always willing to mix up the waters a bit. So we'll see, you know. I hope I'm around to see a little bit of my own legacy.
There you go.
Yep.
So maybe we'll talk again. The legacy is to be continued.
And by the way, I haven't quite finished it yet, so don't jump the gun here.
Exactly. That's why there's no need to give the legacy speech yet. We'll wait until you make your announcement. And if we do a season two, then we'll talk about it then. But I really appreciate your time coming on the show. It's just me. This is for the greater good of New Jersey. I have a full-time job. This is not it. This is information gathering. So we'll put this out for all the viewers. And we wish that, hope that people will share it widely and gain a very worthwhile perspective. I think we hear that the people that actually spend the time listening to a full episode and getting to know somebody that's part of the state fabric and advocating for something in any capacity, it gets really good feedback. So thank you for being a part of it. And thank you for coming on and making the time. And I genuinely appreciate it. And I wish you the best and your decisions with your career coming up and in general with you and your family. So thank you.
Thank you, Ryan, and thank you for all you do.
All right, I appreciate it. We'll
Happy New Year to all of your residents, to all of the viewers here, and hopefully we can reconvene and start looking backwards at COVID-19 instead of ahead.
Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, talk of the town. Garden State Bay. For people all around, yeah. Garden State Bay.
Garden State Bay.
Garden State Bay.
Yeah.
State Bay.